Les colloques du Collège de France.
Welcome back, everyone, to the second of our afternoon talks. It's a great pleasure to welcome Gabor Brody. I would like to read his title to you, but I don't quite know how to say the indices, but I'll say it without the indices. Variables keep themselves separate. Gabor.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me. And let me know if I start walking away from the microphone, which will almost certainly happen at some point. So I will come back then. All right. So let me start by talking about a question that seemed to be not directly relevant to the topic at hand, which is on a project that we done recently where we asked whether perception can encode multiple possibilities. And in this project, we basically started out with a set of predictions. And our predictions were that if this possibility is about object features, then perception, object perception should be able to encode them. And if it is about object locations, then object perception shouldn't be able to encode them. Thank you. I'm going to very quickly show you a bit of the study, but I don't expect I'm not trying to explain the full design, just to get an intuition for what we did. So we were interested in whether people bind the shapes to the disks that they are presented on after occlusion. And in the known identities condition, you can see that there's a deterministic mapping between shapes and disks. But in the possible identities task, there is no deterministic mapping, right? Like either of the shapes can be revealed on either of the disks, and we were interested in whether people can represent both of these possible mappings. So maybe this intuition will be even easier to see with the locations task. Here, we contrasted this known locations case, where we know where this object goes, with cases where we didn't know where the object goes. And we were interested in whether participants can sort of, in their perceptual system, encode that the disk can be in both of these locations. And the upshot of this study has been that these predictions basically borne out exactly. That when it comes to representing possible features, the perceptual system had no trouble doing it. But when it came to possible locations, then the perceptual system wasn't able to do this. OK, so why did we predict this exact pattern? The answer to that is that it basically follows from what I will call the variable theory of object perception. And what I mean by this, what I mean by variables, is that there is some type of cognitive apparatus that separates addressing. So this will be the creation and maintenance of indices 1 to n from something that's external to indices. So this really depends on what type of variable theory we have. It can be predicates, descriptions, properties, features, etc. I'm going to use the term cargo. I would like to use the term content, but that's taken, so it's going to be cargo. So for object files, what we mean by addressing is basically or thought of as object tracking. And what we think about cargo is features that we bind to these tracked objects. When it comes to our particular study that we ran, we had a claim about addressing, which is that two claims, which is that indices are encoded at disjoint locations. So that would mean that this type of setup is not, you cannot say that the object is here. This is two locations. And the other claim is that indices have to be in some type of one-to-one correspondence with objects. So you cannot have two possible indexes with the objects. Right? So this is the claim about cargo. Contrast this with about addressing. Contrast this with our claim about cargo, which is that whatever we have in terms of retained features, we have to match them to our available indices to the best of our ability. All right. I want to start by saying that I think this is a really good theory of object perception, and I really hope that like the core insight of it is right. But the critical thing that I want to point out is that this is fundamentally two theories. We have a theory of addressing, which is quite predictive and it's very restrictive. It tells very exactly what the perceptual system should be and not able to do. And we have a much more descriptive theory of the cargo, which basically just says, use the features, be Bayesian, do the best that you can to map the features back to the indices. I would argue that this is a core aspect of many what I call variable theories. They sort of take a radical degree of freedom. They sort of separate a theory of one phenomenon. We would want one theory optimally, and they decide to have make two theories out of it. But they can pay for this sort of radical freedom by having a very restricted theory of how addressing works. All right, there are three critical ingredients for having these strong predictions when it comes to the visual domain. So the first one, we talked about it already in previous talks, is this idea of division of labor, right? So address maintenance have to be somewhat separate from the maintenance of cargo. And this makes a lot of sense because without making this delineation, there is no explanatory benefit of having a very restrictive theory of addressing if whatever information I have from cargo can just be used to make predictions. The second property is that this system has to be more or less modular. So this is an extension of division of labor that would mean something like, however I work with the addresses, it has to be encapsulated from beliefs at large. And the reason for this is that, as opposed to my perceptual system, I can perfectly solve the possible locations task that I showed you. I know that the object can be in either of these locations. It's only according to our measurements, my perceptual system that doesn't seem to know that it can be in either of these possible locations. And basically falling out from these two properties, the third property is that the identity of indexes have to be what I will call somewhat incorrectly tautological. And what I mean by tautological is that every identity statement should be always evaluated straightforwardly, true or false, based on nothing else but the index. So object one is always identical to object one and it's never identical to object two. This is the main three things that allows us to make these strong predictions. So the question in this talk will be whether these course files are like this or not. This will be the question I will try to address. So these course files, I'm going to sort of speak in generalities. Of course, there are many different theories, but they all use variables where addressing, at least in some theories, is done by the grammar, and the cargo is predicates or descriptions. And for instance, a study on discourse reference, we would have an example claim about addressing, which would be something like anaphoric pronouns can pick out already introduced discourse reference. And the example claim about cargo would be that you have to connect descriptions to indices to the best of your ability given the sentence you heard. So do discourse files have the three critical properties I talked about? I think when it comes to division of labor, most views in linguistics would say yes. But many semantic theories take this division of labor so seriously that they sometimes completely abstract away from any idea of cargo or even any idea of representation, and they just say that the assignment function kind of connects indices to entities, and that's all we have to say about this. When it comes to modularity, I think this is true, generally speaking. The idea is that indexing happens in the grammar, encapsulated from pragmatics and belief. And the classic evidence for this is the fact that truth conditionally equivalent sentences seemingly have different anaphoric potentials. And you can explain this by pointing to the formal properties of sentences, which I'm going to call this fact, the formal link requirement. And finally, exactly because of this, the identity of these indexes are always sort of tautological in the sense I use this word. All right, so I think there are challenges on all three of these fronts. So when it comes to division of labor, I think there are very strong evidence, especially from developmental psychology, that addressing seems to be highly influenced by information in the cargo. So mutual exclusivity is a paradigm case where descriptors influence how reference is understood over and beyond the grammar. When it comes to modularity, there's a lot of work that kind of implies that we can reimagine all this addressing that happens in, as part of cooperative communication and not of grammar. Finally, there are sort of analyses of identity statements that take it to mean, so Superman is Clark Kent and similar sentences, that imply that you can merge these files, and such merging would make this property not true. All right, so today I'm going to argue that there's still possibly a strong case to be made for this modular view that I'm advocating. So when it comes to the division of labor, I will try to present some developmental data. I will actually present it that indicates that the critical mechanism behind mutual exclusivity is grammatical. When it comes to modularity, I will present some psycholinguistic evidence that sort of implies, at least to some degree, that cooperative considerations do not enter into index maintenance beyond the formal link requirement. And when it comes to identity, I will argue that even if mental files are indeed getting merged, discourse reference keep themselves separate. All right, so let's start with the first challenge, which is the division of labor. So this is what I take to be the received wisdom in psychology. Grammar develops slowly, but infants, children have very strong intuitions about cargo, in particular nouns and sort of kinds. In fact, they seem to think that such descriptions have the power to individuate objects, so one object should have one sort of or one noun descriptor. And this looks quite bad, right? Like if it is cargo rather than grammar that individuates object already at that point, then that doesn't really look good for this view. The paradigm example for this type of evidence, I think, is mutual exclusivity, and I think a lot, if not all, of the findings boil down to thinking about mutual exclusivity. So I will talk about mutual exclusivity, and this work is joint with Roman Feynman and Brown and Atul Yerevan. All right, so mutual exclusivity is a phenomenon where a novel noun descriptor is assumed to apply to an object that lacks a salient noun descriptor. So if I would ask you which one is the Dex, you would assume that it's the unnamed or yet to be named object. And infants at 12 months, and children especially, seem to make this assumption. So this is a very general, very robust, very replicated effect, and works sometimes even better if you name the other object in the context as well. So if you point to the red object and you say that's a wug, and then you ask for the Dex, now you still have the expectation that Dex refers to the unnamed object. So the question I'm trying to answer is, why do children assume this? And this is, of course, a very classic question, so I'm going to very quickly walk you through the classic explanations. So the first classic explanation is that children have a bias either on conceptual or on word learning ground. And I think mental files would also be a sub version of this type of explanation. Here the idea is that the child thinks that apple is named apple, so Dex have to mean something else, and the only something else they have in the context is the other thing. Dex have to mean the other thing. There's another class of explanation that basically uses the same logic, but now the learner assumes something about pragmatics. So in this case, the idea would be that if the speaker meant apple, they should have said apple, but they did not say apple, they must have meant something else. Finally, there's a third class that I really just mention in passing, where you just have some domain general or other system that sort of force one-to-one mappings between objects and labels. So these are quite different, obviously, but they share a couple of fundamental features. The first feature is that they all consider mutual exclusivity to demonstrate that children have inbuilt ways to structure how utterances with descriptions refer, right? And because of this, they all try to do the same thing. They try to posit some type of internal process that can bias a learner to interpret these otherwise unbiased looking descriptions, right? Like these novel words have no principled bias in them. Why do children treat them as they are biased? And because of they do the same thing, they have the same type of issues. So the first issue, which is an issue for our cases, for my case, is that it seems to reveal that information in the cargo is driving this joint filing, which is exactly the opposite that I'm arguing for. But the second issue, which is general and also came up in previous discussion, is that word meanings, even for nouns, are very much not mutually exclusive. We can have multiple different words to talk about one object, and they can be on different levels of hierarchy or orthogonal to the hierarchy. Why would children and even adults have such strong biased expectations for something that seems to be kind of incorrect? All right, so what we are going to argue for is that mutual exclusivity does not reflect biased expectations, but instead it reflects a grammatical competence. And our starting point for this is that language have sort of dedicated ways to mark contrast in speech. And what we propose is that there might be linguistically encoded ways to show, to derive mutual exclusivity. And our candidate mechanism here is focus, right? Focus is a linguistic marker of contrast that's thought to be part of the sentence structure. So I'm going to mark it with this capital F. And what focus does is that it indicates that whatever constituents are marked, it has a distinct and contrasted meaning with some salient alternative in the discourse. In English, it's marked with special prosody. In Hungarian, it's word order. Other languages use morphology. There are many different ways of doing this. So to get a sense of this, I'm sorry, my English prosody is horrible, but I think it will work. You can imagine a context in which someone says, this is a great workshop, and it would be completely fine to respond to this by saying, this is an amazing workshop, right? And the inference that you make here is that the conference is not just great, but amazing. But you cannot really respond to this by saying, even if it was true, this is a hybrid workshop, right? And this shows that you really need a contrastive concept here. It doesn't really make much sense to say that the workshop was not great, but hybrid. These don't seem to be contrasting in the way focus requires them to. So how should this explain mutual exclusivity? The idea is that in experimental settings, children get a focus noun that contrasts with a salient alternative. In the classic named object mutual exclusivity cases, the experimenter themselves points to one of the objects and says that's a wok, so that's the alternative in those cases. And in the familiar object mutual exclusivity, the listener, the child themselves have to sort of self-provide a salient noun for themselves that we assume they converge on based on their memory. And if this is right, then without focus, there should be no mutual exclusivity. All right. So it's not that straightforward to just remove focus from a sentence and be done. So we have to talk a tiny bit about givenness as well. So givenness is a linguistic marker of familiarity. It's also part of the sentence structure, but it sort of has a complementary role in interpretation. It says that whatever is marked is salient and recoverable from the preceding discourse. In English, it's a very distinguishable de-accenting that it marks it, so it makes it experimentally quite nice. And so that you get a feel of this too, let me use this example. Someone asked, how did you like the workshop? You can say, I like the talks. This de-accenting would mean that the speaker kind of liked the workshop in general. No, I'm sorry, I messed the two up. I like the talks means that the speaker liked the workshop in general. If I would say, I like the talks, there you make the opposite inference, that you like the talks, but there was some other salient aspect of the conference that you didn't like, or the workshop. So, did I mess it up again?
What could that be?
I have no idea. It clearly was created for another workshop. Okay, so now we have both of the pieces for us to have better specified predictions. We predict that if there's focus on a critical noun, then children should assume mutual exclusivity. And if the noun is given, then they shouldn't. So we ran this preferential pointing paradigm with novel objects, where in the focus condition we accented the noun, and in the given condition we de-accented the noun. In both conditions we had focus marking on U, and the reason for that is you need something focused in a sentence, otherwise it just doesn't sound like a sentence in English. And as a first step, we use this target noun toy, because it's a superordinate, and such it can in principle apply to either of the objects, which made the predictions a bit more complex that I'm getting into in a moment, but let me show you the stimuli.
Hi, I'm gonna point to the blicket. Look, I'm pointing to the blicket. Now you point to the toy. Hi, I'm gonna point to the blicket. Look, I'm pointing to the blicket. Now you point to the toy.
Works. The intuition is clear. Okay. So what predictions we can have for children? I'm going to separate cargo accounts and the grammar account. We can imagine two cargo accounts. One would say that you are using toy. Toy is a superordinate noun. There shouldn't be mutual exclusivity in the first place. And we can imagine another cargo account that would say that toy and blicket are different words. Mutual exclusivity applies. In that case, children should select the new object. So this is the rate of going for the novel object. So on the other hand, the grammatical account predicts an asymmetric prediction, which is that only there should be mutual exclusivity as long as the noun is focused. And in fact, children should expect coreference without it. So here are the results from experiment one. Children had a very strong mutual exclusivity effect in the focus condition, and they had a very strong expectation for coreference when it comes to the given condition. So this is a sort of very good start, but I guess you are also wondering whether this had to do with using toy and maybe toy being a special case. So in experiment two and three, we kind of did the same experiment, but now we used a completely novel noun for the second noun. We separated the two experiments because we wanted a large sample for the given condition to make sure that we have the power to detect anything, but this is just so that it makes sense. So what did we find? We find the very same thing. Whether or not you use toy or a novel noun, focus and not the descriptive information that seems to drive indexing for these referential utterances. All right, to summarize, toy seems to be not a special case, and if there's focus, there's mutual exclusivity. Without it, there seems to be none. So, of course, what I said implies that previous studies always had their nouns focused, and that's a very strong claim that I'm absolutely not ready to defend, but this is a very this is basically all the stimuli that I found easily available, just so that you have get an intuition about how people run these studies.
Point at the spoon. Point at the piser.
Watch the blick.
Hi, ich bin Bär. Oh cool, da ist ein Thoma auf dem Tisch. Wie schön, ein Thoma auf dem Tisch. Kannst du mir das Thoma zeigen?
So I don't speak German, but I still feel that the noun is focused. This is the last piece from our previous work.
Hi, baby, look! Where is the work? Work!
I'm sorry, there's going to be one more.
Work!
Okay, so all of these for me feel pretty much in pretty much focused. I don't have strong empirical evidence. It would be nice to do a systematic analysis of all of this, but but this is what I have for now. One more thing I want to point out is that this is, I think, even crops up in writing, so people rarely ever say anything about their sentence prosody in any mutual exclusivity studies. But I noticed that in many cases people sort of italicize the target word in their when they write their method section, and sometimes even specifically when they give the utterance and not when they use the word in other cases. My intuition of these cases is people are just trying to be informative about how they actually run the study, and this italics implies focus. But again, this is just my interpretation. So I showed you children, but infants start to have this expectation quite soon. What do we know about them? I'm going to show a very quick pilot study of 18 infants. It was a very similar design, and basically what we measure here is which object they are looking for after the target word. And you can see that there's a difference between focus and given condition. The two conditions are significantly different, but actually the focus condition is not significantly different from chance. So this is still ongoing work where we are running a bigger replication and hope to see whether infants have this expectation based on information structure or not. All right, taking all of the evidence together, I think there's a case to be made that mutual exclusivity might be a grammar-driven process and not a cargo-driven one. All right, let me talk about the second challenge, which has to do with modularity. So one reason that I mentioned that discourse references are thought to be part of the grammar has to do with cases that show truth conditional equivalence and different anaphoric potentials. So if I tell you that I have 10 marbles and all of the 10 marbles are in the bag except for one, it is probably under the sofa, that it pronoun has no trouble finding the relevant marble. But if I tell you that 9 of the 10 marbles are in the bag, it is probably under the sofa. I can figure out what you are talking about, but it certainly doesn't feel very good. So this is, as I mentioned, it's usually explained as a sort of part of the formal apparatus that connects pronouns to already introduced discourse reference. But there are quite some recent work that reconsiders such examples of part of pragmatic reasoning, right? So indefinites might provide information about the speaker's plan to talk about a novel object to a quantity/manner implicature. There, using an indefinite would be something that listeners could use part of the inferential machinery to figure out what the speaker wants to talk about. So I'm going to talk about the formal link, which is joint work with Magdalena Roszkowski and Vatulia Erwin. So our basic logic in this study is to have a truth value judgment where the truth of the sentence that participants have to evaluate depends on how a pronoun is disambiguated. And in this study, we either have or we don't have a linguistic antecedent, and this is always in the presence of the salient visual object that actually a pronoun can be resolved to. So in experiment one, we were interested in just the basic question is that if you have a salient visually available referent, do you still need at all any of this formal link, or participants can now resolve pronouns to relevant, visually present, sort of straightforward but unintroduced objects? And in experiment two or three, we were interested in whether the antecedent provides information to the listeners that the speaker plans to talk about a new discourse reference. So beyond doing this formal role of introducing an object, does it provide actually information of what the speaker plans to do, or it just helps, or it just basically satisfies this formal link condition? So I'm going to show the type of stimuli we use in experiment one.
I have 10 marbles.
It's synthesized because we have a lot of
trials. 9 of them are gray. It is orange.
Pretty bad.
I have 5 blocks. All of them are pink except for one. It is yellow.
still weird because of the synthesizer, but definitely better. So we manipulated a lot of things. I'm happy to talk about it more in detail, but the main thing that's important here is this, whether there was an antecedent or not. And of course, we had true and false trials, we manipulated the reference sets, etc. There have been a lot of different types of trials. So what are the predictions here? In this case, the grammatical and the pragmatic account predict the same thing, that with an antecedent, you should be better than without an antecedent. It means that you should be more likely to say yes, and you should be faster. So this is reaction times. If it's about just like figuring out what object the speaker wants to talk about, I think you can very much figure it out in both conditions. You would expect something flat in both of these cases. I'm calling this the pure collaboration account here. So these are the results, and again, what we see is that having sort of visual objects there that you can resolve these anaphoric pronouns to in a certain sense are not enough. Oh, I have to speak to you. Thank you. So again, this is sort of a good starting point for our investigations. So in experiment two, we were interested in whether this contrast between plus and minus antecedent contexts were driven by a need of a formal link, or the difference in the ability to figure out the speaker's plan from the preceding sentence. So we had this manipulation where we replaced the personal pronoun it with the indefinite one. And what, so instead of it is blue, we now said one is blue. So one provides basically the same cargo to it, which is to say it doesn't provide any, but it critically doesn't violate the formal link. And here the pragmatic account should predict that listeners basically already know the speaker's plan from the preceding sentence in the plus end, but not in the minus end condition. So certainly they should be faster, and potentially they should also say yes more often. But I think the speed is a cleaner prediction. The grammatical account says that neither of these violates the formal link condition. What matters is whether you met it or not. Both of these should be equivalent. So these are the same predictions. So just you can see it. In the plus end condition, the formal link is met and the plan is specified. In the minus end condition, the formal link is met. The plan is underspecified. I put this sort of pink means that this prediction, I think, is like sort of less straightforwardly follows. So here you can see the results. And what you can see is that there is no difference there's a difference in the minus end condition between experiment one and experiment two, but basically everything else patterns together. So the minus end experiment one is the only condition where the formal link was not met. Any other case, participants are pretty fast in resolving the pronoun. All right, so one of the things that we were wondering is that maybe our design doesn't really let participants to converge on the speaker's plan well enough. Maybe providing them with some explicit knowledge about what the speaker is actually going to do would help. So we added this extra sentence in the beginning where the speaker explicitly says what they are going to talk about. So they say, I will talk about all of the objects, all of the, after introducing the relevant set. And we were interested in whether adding such explicit plan removes the need for an explicit antecedent or not. The predictions are now a tiny bit more complex again because it's unclear whether the true response difference should still hold for the grammatical account because you can sort of reason out what the speaker is saying even in a formal link on met condition, but the strong prediction is that the reaction time difference should still happen because you have to like explicitly reason it out rather than just use your grammatical operations. And this is what we found in experiment three. Participants were a tiny bit more likely to accept, but this difference was not significant, by the way. But other than that, if the formal link was unmet, participants slowed down. So we knew before the truth conditional equivalent sentences have different anaphoric potentials. Experiment 1 implies that visual and communicative salience is insufficient to license such anaphoric pronouns. Again, it's a bit of a category mistake even to say this sentence, but basically certain collaboration views would predict exactly that type of behavior. Finally, experiment 2 and experiment 3, I think, provide some preliminary evidence that knowing what the speaker wants to talk about is also insufficient. So even if we put some of this mechanism into pragmatics, it has to be the type of pragmatics that doesn't sort of correspond to the rest of the belief system. So knowing what the speaker wants to know should not enter, want to say, should not enter the calculation of the relevant implicatures. Taken together, without formal link, participants take longer and reject higher, which makes sense because it's a presupposition failure. This is predicted on the grammatical account, and especially the difference between pronouns and indefinites, where they were accepted and didn't result in a slowdown. Using indefinites in general does not seem to be helpful in converging on the speaker's referent in the following sentence beyond meeting the formal link. So very quickly, I'm going to talk about the third challenge, which is about the variables, and this is joint work with Patrick Elliott. So as I mentioned, the identity of discourse files should be taken as sort of tautological. So any identity statement should be true or false based on nothing but the index. But certain analysis of identity statements, or sometimes called equatives, take the meaning of such sentences as an instruction to merge files. So just to repeat, I'm not going to argue that mental files are not getting merged. In fact, I think that they are getting merged. What I'm going to argue is that discourse reference still under these conditions remain separate, and in that sense, the meaning of these sentences cannot be such an operation. So this is a hypothesis that I think raised but not endorsed in a recent paper. So to be more precise at what I'm going to try to say is that discourse files, both discourse files exist after identity statements, and even stronger, that there is no free flow of information between the discourse files after an identity statement. I think this is evidence, so I'm somewhat unsure, but I think this is also evidence against linking. And as a side note on methodology, I'm going to look at conditionals of the following form. If Superman is Clark Kent, then P. And the reason I do this is that I want to ensure that we are in the relevant words where we accepted that Superman is Clark Kent. So it rules out a type of idea where we interpret these P's in relation to some other perspective using these conditionals. The important caveat here is that it's sort of unclear what the merging linking theory would predict when it comes to any entailment canceling operators, right? So because the system is generally not compositional, it's hard to derive what exactly if Superman is Clark Kent means in this system. But Superman, right? So you can see this from Superman is not Clark Kent clearly means something much stronger than it is not the case that I instruct you to merge files. John thinks that Superman is Clark Kent certainly doesn't mean John thinks that I instruct you to merge the files. But if you don't like my if conditionals, you can just use continuation. So you can say Superman is Clark Kent, P, and let me know if you find sort of differences from what I show. All right, so meet Prince and Camille. Just so that we share a common ground, Camille is Prince's female alter ego. What's critical is that Camille uses she pronouns and Prince uses he pronouns, which allows us to sort of re-identify their respective indices based on the five features. And if you have some particular issue with this identity statement, I think you can change it to any of your liking, but I think a lot of things are clearer when you have this gender, this five-feature contrast. All right, so what evidence do we have against index merging? The first clue, I think a lot of this data is in the literature, and I'm just going to use a stronger interpretation than previously. taken. So the first evidence is that the use of plural pronouns, right? So if Prince is Camille, then they are one person, that seems perfectly fine. If Prince is Camille, then he is one person, that seems very bad. If Prince is Camille, then they are two people, again, pretty bad. So I think what one versus three shows that we are really in the right believers, right? The fact that three is bad and one is good implies that we cannot be sort of looking from a perspective where the identity statement doesn't hold. So we are certainly after whatever the antecedent does, and we accepted that. And I think the critical data from one versus two is that there is no singular discourse referent from whose he is one person would be informative, right? The reason this sounds weird too is that it's redundant. You might worry that this is just some type of syntactic fact, maybe even non-referential nominals would require plural pronouns, but they don't. If the second Bush is Jeb, the other verse politician clearly doesn't work, at least as a plural pronoun. All right, so one straightforward worry that you might have is that maybe this is a singular day, right? We already discussed it. And also, maybe we just use plural pronouns for whatever reason, but that doesn't seem to necessitate that we have to have two sort of separate representations. But I think the fact that you can have relations between such identical people, that kind of implies that is the case. So if Prince is Camille, then they have the same eye color. The same relation requires a plurality of entities to hold between. Otherwise, no one else has the same eye color as themselves. Even worse, if Prince is Camille, then they dress differently. It's a perfectly good sentence. Different against requires a plurality of entities, but critically, they have different properties. Otherwise, the statement wouldn't feel true. So I think that kind of implies it's like a sort of first pass evidence that it's not the case that whatever we know, whatever is true of one holds of the other in a relevant way. All right. The third clue has to do with binding principles. So these are the set of principles that control how pronouns and reflexives can and cannot co-refer with a referential term in a sentence. So principle A says that reflexives have to be bound locally. They need a co-referential antecedent in the same clause. So because of this, Prince is Camille. If Prince is Camille, then Prince has his own guitar in the closet. That's perfect. If Prince is Camille, then he has her own guitar in the closet. That's horrible. But if they are the same person, there is no like sort of strong reason that this type of reach should be unavailable, except if the indexes are still separate. Principle B says that pronouns cannot be bound locally, otherwise you have to use the reflexive. So if Prince is Camille, then he looks like her, perfectly fine. If Prince is Camille, then he looks like him. That doesn't make any sense. Even though we are talking about the same individual, why don't we have free reign over the relevant pronoun that we use? Principle C says that the referential term cannot be bound anywhere. And in line with this, if Prince is Camille, then he approves of Camille's music. Perfect. She approves of Camille's music. Violates principle C. So when it comes to binding, identity statements seem to be completely inert. So Prince is Camille works exactly the same if I would change this to Prince is related to Camille or Prince is the twin of Camille, etc. There is seemingly no relationship between indexing and identity. All right, so I have some more tentative evidence against the free flow of information, which is, like I mentioned, the first piece, which is they dress differently, implies that there is some separation. But I want to say a tiny bit more about this. So take it for background knowledge that Prince is from Minnesota. So saying Prince is from Minnesota is just redundant. We are doing this. So if you would say that, it's strikingly perfectly informative and reasonable to say that if Prince is Camille, then she's from Minnesota. There is no way that this is not true, given will let me know, and nevertheless, it's like the redundancy is the same, nevertheless, one is good and the other is not. If Prince is Camille, then he's from Minnesota again, but, and I think this is, I'm a tiny bit unsure on this judgment, but I would like it if it would be true. So if Prince is Camille, then Camille is from Minnesota too. That seemingly presupposes that someone else is from Minnesota, which is it's just not the case. No one else is from Minnesota. Again, if Prince is Camille, then Prince is from Minnesota too. That is as bad as it should be if it's a presupposition failure. All right. One open question here that I have no answers to is whether the Prince / Camille reading is even available anywhere. Is that, can we use a discourse referent to talk about that individual? I tried and absolutely failed to find a case for a clear read where a singular pronoun would be able to pick out Prince-Camille outside of introducing them as Prince-Camille. That's the only way I can get a clear read for the amalgam reading for this case. All right. So to sum up, we need a level of representation where identity statements do not affect the indexes because, as a matter of fact, they seem to stay separate. This separation, I think, is not audience management. It's not a type of perspectival simulation because the data comes from these if conditionals that ensures that we are only looking at the relevant words. And I think this is a good result because it maintains a clear differentiation between discourse reference in the grammar, but also allows independently to update our beliefs and mental files based on the information. So I will end with this quote from the paper I started with. Learning identities might not have the power for reasons of cognitive architecture to affect the autonomous level of coindexation, how our language referential apparatus carves up the word into distinct individuals need not match our conceptual distinctions. So I this is what I take from this data as well. All right, I have one slide for general discussion. Am I out of time?
You are out of time, but just be quick.
Okay. So I think object files are one of the most productive ideas that we had in cognitive science. And I think not accidentally, they are one of the most disproved ideas. And I think, I think this is really what making predictions does to you. You get disproved, and some of those disproving, I think you can wiggle yourself out of. And I think for in both of these cases, there, for object files and discourse reference, there basically tries to get all of this restricted addressing out of encapsulation and be part of domain general cognition. And I think the more we treat these, both of these systems as modular, non-rational systems, the sort of cleaner, stronger, more counterintuitive predictions we can sort of eke out of them. Like when it comes to object files, it would be incredibly rational for humans to represent that they can be at possible locations. Like if I saw something adaptive ever, that's certainly adaptive to know that an object can be in multiple locations. The same way for discourse reference, I think it would be rational to merge them, to accommodate them with ease when we can converge on the right object, to use cargo rationally in their indexing. But the fact that these processes don't occur are sort of very good evidence for the strong frameworks that predict these irrational looking behaviors. And with this, I want to thank you for your attention. And these are my collaborators, and I'm very grateful for all the conversation I had with different people on different parts of this work.
Right, thank you. Let's move to questions. And as before, put your hands up now, and I'll get a track of a few early questions. But if you don't put your hand up now, just do try and get in later, because I want to come to people who haven't yet thought of a question as well. Let's start in the middle here.
Hi. I just had a really quick one about the the study using focus. So the end result of that is that you feel like you have shown that, not that there isn't an effect like the mutual exclusivity effect, but there's that the previous thing that looked like evidence of it is not in fact evidence of it. So I'm just wondering if you're thinking of then testing a different way to see if there is that effect, or because it struck me that when you use the falling intonation, then you also prejudice it. So you just can't really do it with speech very easily, but you could do, not with infants, but you could do like a written version of it that then wouldn't be prejudiced in terms of that variable. So that's all.
Thank you, that's a great question. So when it comes to written versions, I don't think that works because people come up with their prosody in written versions, they use whatever cue they have, even if you don't provide the cue. So prosody is not focus, prosody is how we mark it. And if I read a text, I will create my information structure based on that text using my best inferences. But when it comes to testing it, whether there is a bias or not, I think Hungarian might be a very good test case, because in Hungarian, I'm not a good enough linguist to verify this claim, but I think you can get to these environments where you can have a referentially, genuinely ambiguous construction that's neither focused nor given. But a lot of this depends on framework as well. And even if you, I think the general point besides whether focus in and of itself would do the effect is whether you can have a sentence that's absolutely void of any information structure. So I think the answer to that is probably no, and that would be the natural test. I'm not married to focus per se. I'm married to the idea that there are information structural constraints that will enter into evaluating these utterances.
Right, there's another one here, and then we'll go to the back.
Okay, it works? Okay. I have a question for you and for Michael Huema. When you introduced, I had to wake him up to that. When you introduced your distinction between access and cargo, you said one piece of evidence is that children understand the uncertain or the possibility of an object having different properties, but not being in different locations.
So no, I only talked about so the first study you mean that I very quickly presented. That's an adult perception study where we find that the adult perceptual system is only able to encode possible locations and not possible identities, which actually maps very well to the thing that most people find in childhood, which is that they are better with features compared to locations as well. But that's just as far as I yeah.
But Michael yesterday told me there is no evidence for that with the children, at least
that they are better with
I think there are. And,
so
I
I think it's misrepresentation.
Can we, Mike? Can you get the mic, and then you're welcome to come in on this.
So I think in the children's studies, they can always be explained by different predictions, for instance, of what we call minimal representations of possibilities. So for the audience, we think that children are, when they see, for instance, a cup where reward is put in, and there's a pair of cups where another reward is hidden in one of the two cups, and then they choose roughly 50-50 between the single and the member of the pair. And what we think here is that they simulate in which cup of the pair one of the prizes is, and they take this as reality, as they take where the prizes in the single cup, right? And a lot of our recent work goes that children at this age, and we speak of three-year-olds mostly, are able to present what better than where, right? But our account makes the prediction that in all these what studies that at least I know of, they should be 75%, right? And that's basically what is mostly found, right? That's what Josef is referring to. Yes. Sorry for that long.
So I have absolutely no horse in the whether children represent possibilities debate. I think one can extend and ask whether can we recharacterize minimal representation of possibility in terms of what are the things that perception gives you or doesn't give you. That would be a possible project that I think someone can do, but I'm not doing it.
Another question in the back row there, Woody.
Hi, thank you for your very interesting talk. I don't know if my question has already been addressed, so do let me know. So I was going to ask about the third experiment. So I feel like all the examples like Prince and Camille and maybe Hesperus, Phosphorus, a commonality of all of them is that, well, the like purported like distinct things, they have different qualities that are qualitatively different. So there's a chance that, well, we have like separate like conceptual representation or distinctions because of that like difference in qualities. So I don't know if you and your colleagues have tested like qualitatively identical things like I don't know, like maybe one cup like in front of me and I turn my head to the other side and put it away so I can like suspect whether this cup is that cup, but they are like qualitatively identical. I suspect that the predictions and result will be the same, but I don't know.
So I'm not sure that I completely got the direction of your question, but in some sense, if Prince is Camille, then they have the same properties. That there have to be a sense in which that's what the sentence is saying, and when we say that they are the same people, I agree that we are saying something else about them, that they have, in their different guises, they have different properties. I think my intuition is that it shouldn't depend on whether you use any objects that you already know different properties of. If there are different guises of anything, they have to have different properties too, right? Like if it's the same cup, then but here and then there, then they look differently from here than from there. So I'm unsure whether there's a clean case where every property is the same.
So the sentence would be something like, you know, you looked at a cup, then you took it away, and then another cup appeared, and then you'd say something like, if this cup is the first cup, then they are one cup. That would be the analog. So then I guess the question is, how do we feel about that sentence, right? It does feel a little weirder to me than that one.
Yes, I wonder whether what the demonstrative is doing there in this, which, yeah.
Right, we're going to come forward in the question after this one, but first, Francois.
Okay, so first regarding I like the talk tonight, regarding the distinction between the address and the cargo, it's sort of complicated. Well, of course, I also draw a distinction between, say, the file and the contents of the file, the conception, whatever, that corresponds to cargo. But there is this open issue of whether or not the file involves some component, like a sortal component, that would not be part of the contents of the file, but would be something that would be more closely associated to the file itself, which is the thing that has this indexing role. And it's actually an open issue. So, and you consider that in your discussion of mutual exclusivity, that this thing, the sortal, is something that essentially belongs to the contents of the file, as it were. So that's sort of, again, an open issue. So there certainly are more positions, possible positions that this suggests. But anyway, the data, that's quite interesting. Now, regarding the last part, and the more, for me, the most interesting stuff about this merging of non-merging of and so on. So I have to look in more details. I don't know exactly what to say about your interesting examples. But the way I think, I agree with you that basically, I mean, I agree on the data, but the identity statements according to which not only they do not imply that the files are merged, but they presuppose that they are distinct files, that the files are cross-tri-indexed. So it's very, very important property. So whenever you have this identity predicates or this relation of identity, you know that there would be contra-indexing, so just the opposite of merging. And I think that's the case in many of your examples. There is identity somewhere. So I'm not so sure about what exactly the examples show, given that fact. And the merging of indexes, if it were to occur, it would occur not, of course, in the sentence or discourse that contains this identity predicate, but after the identity has been processed. Actually, the identity itself, of course, the person who says A is B is someone who knows the identity, so presumably that person has a single mental file about the thing, but this is addressed to someone who doesn't know the identity, and that presupposes the point of view of the addressee, as it were. So it's complicated because there are two points of view at the same time. So it makes the analysis of these cases complicated. But if we look at simpler cases in which some identity has been processed, you learn that two things were the same, you're no longer thinking of them as two different things, then that's the case in which possibly the indices would merge too. It's not so this distinction between the indices and the mental files, the more conceptual mental files, it's not clear that that is necessary. It depends on the sort of examples we look at. And I'm not sure, but I was thinking about an old example from Irene Heim, in which he uses one of them as the sort of discourse reference introducers. So if John or Mary comes to the party, one of them, or maybe if they come to the party, one of them would bring wine or something like this. What's interesting here, so that clearly, so there is this, you've got this file for John, for Mary, but you have this additional discourse file for the one of them that we're talking about, which is indeterminate. But if you continue, you say, if it's Mary, or if it's John, and in that case, surprisingly, I don't know why, but we cannot, if we continue, if it's Mary, you have to say, she will do X. You cannot use a pronoun anaphoric on the discourse. I mean, you cannot continue to exploit the discourse referent and use the same pronoun, like say he. If you say one of them will bring this and he will and so on, then you've got this chain, this anaphoric chain, where you use he to actually co-refer to that discourse referent. But if you introduce this identity, if it is Mary, then you cannot do that anymore. You've got to say she.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but maybe you do.
So I think that I'm not sure I have enough math, but my intuition about these particular cases, I will respond also to the sortals and the merging, that's exactly what the conditional does. We are only considering a certain set of words in which, if it was her, and that would be my intuition. And that, going back to the previous case.
But why is it not possible to continue to use he, referring to one of them?
So the data is that if you say that if it's Mary, he might not come at all, after all, or something like that. That's not that's judged ungrammatical or infelicitous. So I think I'm not seeing the full pattern of data well enough, that if one of them will bring wine, if it's Mary, he will bring bread, that's not good. For me, that sounds pretty okay, but I'm not sure about the complete pattern enough to have a strong feeling. When it comes to these examples, I think I completely agree with the idea that wherever the merging happens is just not in the discourse context. That's, I think, what I want to say, because because that's what the conditional does. It takes the antecedent and goes where we did what the antecedent asked us to do. So if in those cases we don't immediately have any cognitive effects of that happening, I mean, we obviously have cognitive effects of that happening, because I can say that if Superman is Clark Kent and they are one person, that shows that I know what you meant. It's not like I'm simulating anything. It's I feel like in the linguistic system somewhere we have to keep them separate, and wherever the merging happens and wherever the later things happen, that will have to be a different theory of addressing in to some degree. But
do you want to address the bit about the sortals?
Yes. So I believe that sortals are a fundamental interest of human creatures, and they are, and if there's one property that has to be attached to every, that has to be part of every cargo, it's going to be that sortal information. But I still feel that there is not enough evidence to say that that is used in the addressing. That I feel like that there is a good research project in trying to explain away all data to the contrary. And actually, I think that similar arguments can be made for the visual cases, where people also started to bring in more and more featural information in addressing, and some of them are quite strong, but a lot of them that people cite are actually not that strong for sort of featural interference into object file addressing. So I think in both cases there are sort of possible bigger research projects in trying to like maintain the strongest version of the hypothesis.
Let's go to Karen.
Hi. So super cool talk. It's very cool to find out that my views are being put to empirical testing. Less cool that they're proving me wrong, but so it goes. Having said that, I had some concerns and complications about the setup of the experiment too, about the plans versus like the formal link experiments. So mostly it has to do with how the plan is specified, and then whether or not we should still expect there to be a greater processing time. So the plan was specified with something like, I will talk about all of them, like the marbles.
That's experiment three.
In that's experiment three.
Experiment two is okay. Just the indefinite is used.
Oh, just the, sorry, experiment three. Sorry.
Okay.
Experiment three, where the plan is specified, where they say, I will talk about all of them. The thing is, that specifies a plan to talk about the marbles in general, one. And so it doesn't sort of raise your expectations enough after you've talked about whatever they were, the yellow ones, that the next sentence is going to be about the blue ones, because the speaker hasn't done anything to set that up. That's what you get with the formal link, but that's also what's missing. There's nothing about the plan that specifies that you're going to talk about the yellow ones and then about the last one. So at the very least, I would think that the plan would have to indicate that you're going to talk about all and only the marbles, so and say very minimal things about them, so that once you've talked about the yellow marbles, you're really set to think that there's nothing else that the speaker could possibly go on to say except talking about the remaining blue marble. So that's one. And so you would expect when the speaker, in the way you have it set up, that when you get to it is blue, there's still going to be this extra processing time, because you sort of have to retrieve from the very general plan to talk about all the marbles, that now we're sort of in a space where we're going to talk about the specific remaining marble. So that was the first sort of concern about just how the plan is specified. The other concern is sort of maybe a complication for setting up any of these kinds of experiments, in terms of that we have default ways of doing things, right? And so even if I specifically tell you my plan, either within a discourse or within like any domain where we could be planning, and then I execute that plan in a really unexpected way, it might take you more time to sort of cognize what it is I'm doing, even if you can get what I'm doing, right? Even if that was like, I told you a plan about what I'm about to do, and then I do it in a very expected way. And that's sort of like, I think, also well tested within like linguistic processing, that even if I say something in an unexpected way, it might take people more time to process it. And so then again, just given we have very well set up defaults for how anaphora works, where we do use that formal link most of the time, you might expect that even when the plan is specified, the fact that that plan's then enacted in a way that is contrary to our default expectations is going to create an increased processing time.
Do you have another question? Because I'm sorry, I started.
That was the end of my question.
So first of all, just to make clear that I think these are really just the first steps in looking at this. I don't think that this is the end of the story. But the critical piece of data for me is not really experiment three, where I take your intuition. We try to push the plan more so that we can maybe find an effect of it. But I agree with you that it can be a better plan. It can be sort of something that. I think the best data pattern that we could have got there for the formal link would have been if this goes really high, right? Like if everyone agrees and successfully disambiguates, but at the end of the day they still take longer time, that would have been better data. I don't think that this is the better evidence. The better evidence for me is experiment two, where we just instead of it we use one. So I feel like in that case it's hard to say. So people are just as fast, but we didn't use the traditional thing that we should use, which is the it pronoun, which is completely licensed. And so I think that's harder to really completely cash out without something that there's a formal requirement. But I, yeah.
Thanks. Let's go to here on the end, please.
Thank you. The talk is very good, and I want just to push you on one thing. Take a case that's completely fictional. Jekyll is the good doctor, and Hyde is the psychopath, criminal, violent. Then he dies, and they realize that his facial feature can change depending on this pill that he takes, this potion. Now, my reaction, but I think the reaction of everybody who read the discourse, which in this case is a piece of fiction, is E is good and not good. Why do I think it's a case of merging? Because I actually had two indexes. I have an index for Hyde and an index for Jekyll. And then I borrow from Hans a terminology. I get a merged thing where the anchor is the body. Is the corpse of this guy. That was Jekyll and Hyde. How do you parse it out in terms of identity that is tautological in your terminology? It's a sort of different question. But my reaction, and show me where I'm wrong, is that there is an actual merging of indexes. There was an index for the good doctor, an index for the criminal, violent perpetrator, whatever you call it, and you merge them because you come to the, whatever you call it, knowledge, acquaintance, the extra layer of information, which in fact the story is very strange. There was a medicine that changed the good person into this violent, absurd deal. And it seems to me a case of merging. And while I can understand that, you say, now, look, with the mental files, still remain different. There would be a file named Dr. Jekyll and a file named the bad guy, Hyde. But if I anchor them to a single body, it seems to me that the index is merging. And then you have a sort of proto-explanation of why these things have contradictory property. He, sub I, that guy, is good, or was good, and was not good. Thank you for explaining what's wrong with my mind.
So I don't think we disagree at all. You know, for this case, I would say that the best of my understanding, we both think that there is index merging, and we both think that you can talk about the body as its own thing. I think I made a much more restricted claim that when it comes to talking about these entities, then there will be things specific to the linguistic system that don't get merged. So whether or not we conceptually, what type of maintenance we do, I separate it out from how we get to refer to things. I think the indexes that we have for thinking about them have to merge. In some sense, that's what it means to understand that they were the same people, and I have no particular issue with the idea that the anchoring relationship has to do with the body at all. So I in some sense, I think there's agreement. This is very particular to how discourse unfolds and how we get to talk about entities, not right. Yeah.
Sorry, we're out of time, so we're going to have to stop there. And it's such an ironic note to have the mental files people and the discourse reference people both accommodated, so it's a good place to stop. Let me just remind you, we've got another coffee tea break before the final session of the day, so back here at 5:30 for the last talk. But before that, join me in thanking the board.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.